Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean on the show called Getting It Done. It is very interesting and downright sad to think about how poorly black people have been treated here in this country. And from one period to the next, in the founding and the development of this country up to the present time, our show is going to discuss some of those elements of what you call racism. And it's going to be actually a woman who's speaking from, actually she's the head of the Mississippi ACLU. I found her very enlightening, and I think you will enjoy the presentation. So let's listen to this presentation by the head of the ACLU.
He had the sense, under threat of censure, to apologize, saying that he had used a poor choice of words that conveyed to some the impression that he embraced the discarded policies of the past. Nothing could be further from the truth, he said. And he said he apologizes to anyone who was offended by his comments. Unlike Senator Lott, when Mississippi Senator Sammy Hyde Smith made racially charged comments, she refused repeatedly to clarify her comments about attending a public hanging during a press conference defended by Governor Phil Bryant. Now, we understand that these are not just speech, and we're not here to condemn hateful speech, which we know is no joking matter, but we are seizing this opportunity to address ignorance as a teaching moment. Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith needs to brush up on her state's history to fully understand the breadth of her despicable comments. Is blemished with blood. The blood flows from the wounds inflicted as we traverse from slavery and slave patrol to racial terrorism in the form of lynching, from lynching to black codes, from black codes to over-policing communities of color, from over-policing communities of color to being at the head of the table for mass incarceration, particularly of African-American men. Mississippi continues to reel from institutionalized racism that was codified in the form of Jim Crow law. We continue to strive to overcome barriers, to exercise the fundamental access to democracy, the right to vote. These barriers regarding voting include voter suppression and disenfranchisement. We may not often see it today. We may not often see racialized terrorism displayed as strange fruit hanging from a tree. But we see it in the practices and the policies enacted that continue to shackle us to the whipping post of poverty. Mississippi continues to hobble our children by a denial of education as a right and the intentional underfunding of our public schools. Our state officials continue to exploit and attempt to control women by curtailing access to their own health care decisions and yet fail to ensure that the 49% of Mississippi households led by women receive equitable pay. Mississippi continues to hold captive over 22,000 people on a daily basis, many as a result of minor and nonviolent offenses. The disparate impact of these policies made by those who are ignorant or who choose to cling to a revisionist history they call heritage reminds us that words matter and race matters. result of racialized policy making throughout the country, people of color are improperly suspected of wrongdoing while going about their own lives. When walking to school, driving to work, hanging out at the barbecue in their own backyard, meeting people at Starbucks, or visiting college campuses. And in many ways, elected officials feel emboldened to ignore these experiences experienced by people of color. Present-day racial discrimination disparities are rooted in false stereotypes. And violence holds us. Structures that perpetuate the impact of past discrimination against communities of color, force removal of indigenous people, create biased policing, and cause us to experience decades of legalized racial discrimination. Again, let me be clear. Tonight's event is not a political activity. This is not a partisan ploy. Tonight's event is public education. Tonight is not about a condemnation nor an endorsement of any candidate. Once again, the ACLU does not endorse or oppose candidates. Our event tonight will take a factual look at the history of racial violence and discrimination in Mississippi and America. We will discuss the importance of holding ourselves and our leadership accountable so that we can learn from our past. You may have noticed that there is a reserved seat on the front row. We cordially invite sitting Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, as we believe that this could be a moment for education and an opportunity for a duly appointed U.S. Senator to show sincere regret. You will notice, however, that that front row seat remains empty. For those of you who are here, however, again, welcome to our front row seat. Now let me move us forward and introduce to you all one of my personal heroes. Back in 2014, I had been in this position for about 6 months, and I had been invited to Tupelo to speak on Dr. Martin Luther King's holiday. And as I was driving that long drive to Tupelo, I tuned my radio to find something to listen to. As I turned the dial, I heard a strong voice, and I paused to listen for a moment. That moment lasted throughout the interview on MTV. I was inspired by what was said, and I made a note to myself to ask one of my staff members who attended the church where this lady said she attended, which is New Hope, to get her contact information for me. Ms. Blondie, I don't know if you remember that, but I sent you an email, and I said, you don't know me from Adam, but I would ask that you take me under your wing and teach me. Again, she didn't know me from Adam, but her response was, I will share whatever information I have. And it's because of that same spirit that I am honored and humbled to introduce her tonight. Like many of us, she left Mississippi for a while, but returned home. The state she came back to was not the home that she seemed to remember. Many years earlier, Medgar Evers had been recently murdered, and that story filled the front pages of newspapers across the country. Busloads of college students were making their way to Mississippi to help black residents register to vote. Jim Crow was alive and well, and despite the edicts handed down out of Washington, D.C. regarding voting rights, there was resistance in Mississippi. And our local governments were managing to preserve the status quo. All eyes were on Mississippi, very much like they are right now. And there was racial unrest. Ms. Blondie knew instinctively that there was work to be done. So she accepted the calling the assignment on her life and put her hand to the plow. During the Civil Rights Movement, she helped register thousands of voters in Mississippi. She was the first African-American female elected official post-Reconstruction in Mississippi. She is a best-selling author of Looking Back to Move Forward, to Move Ahead, which chronicles her journey growing up in a small town, Mississippi, through her work in the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s and 1970s. She worked directly with Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and many other humanitarians, activists, locally and nationally. Her experiences are documented in a 1997 film entitled Standing on My Sister's Shoulders. I said earlier that Mississippi's history is blemished. And yes, Mississippi's history is rich. Mississippi is where history happens that inspired a movement that changed the nation. Mississippi is rich because it is blessed to be the home of national treasures, like our veterans and like Ms. Blunzy Brown Rice. Will you please help me welcome Ms. Blunzy Brown Rice to the stage?
Director Jeff Robinson for giving leadership to this very important and timely discussion. I asked Director Collins if I could just share just one little point about the sitting senator. She told me that I could. Today, I did an interview with National Public Radio that will be aired tomorrow across the country. Last week, I did an interview with one of the local channels about that topic. And what I want to say is just one thing that I said to the TV station there and even this morning, that sometimes people say things because they just simply don't know. So I want to encourage Ms. Highsmith to go to the Civil Rights Museum and visit the hanging gallery. This is the hanging gallery. I want her to rub her hands across the names of our sons and our brothers and our grandchildren and our fathers and our nephews. They are not just statistics, they are names of our people. So that's what I want to talk about. Now for my assignment. Historically and traditionally, as far back as history records and well beyond, there has always been discrimination. I want each of you, just for the next 30 seconds, to just reflect on this evening's topic and ponder this question. What if our ancestors were given the opportunity generations ago to have a front row seat at the table? In your mind, which ancestor are you sitting in for tonight? Just 30 seconds. Thank you. I can imagine that if our ancestors could answer that question, some would say we would never have had slavery, while others would say, I want my children, slaves and ancestors of slaves, to have an equal education. And yet, others may say, We never would have had Jim Crow, Reconstruction, an era of racism, Brown versus the Board of Education, the Civil Rights Movement, and on and on and on. Many would say, we would not have had to work in the fields, in the cotton fields, from sunup until sundown for $1.50 a day. I am confident that they will have various and sundry answers for the question, what if? I can say that 50 years ago, when I was drafted, it was 50 years ago, when I was drafted by my community to run for public office, I did not have, as the old folks said, a good understanding of what it really meant to have a front row seat at the table. I did not understand the power, the responsibility, and yet the accountability that being an elected official, an office holder, and having a front row seat at the table really meant. That was until we as a people clearly understood that our power was in obtaining the right to vote, which granted equal access and equal opportunity to effectuate change in Mississippi and in America. As the first, I faced much opposition from the majority board of election commissioners. As an example, Madison County is 70% African American, and it is comprised of 5 beats and 13 precincts. And each candidate seeking that position would only have to run in his or her beat. But when the Madison County Herald published that a colored woman, had qualified to run for the position of the election commissioner, the current board changed the rules and required that I run in all 5 beats and in all 13 precincts. Now that to me was the real definition of voter suppression. However, sister girls out there, and my friends, the spouses, the male spouses, partners, friends, brothers, uncles, dads, mamas, boys, all of them. In spite of every obstacle that they placed in my path, every obstacle of racial injustice that they created for me, I still need to be in power. By the way, held that position for many years. In my more than 55 years of advocacy, I've witnessed and experienced a multiplicity of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Many of you, perhaps, have also experienced the ugliness of racism and all of its ramifications. So why are we here on this historic Monday night, November 19, 2018. And most importantly, what does it mean to be community? GTE defines community as follows: a place. A community is a place where hope lives next door to expectations, where infinite goals and a myriad of possibilities reside under the same roof, and where the pieces of our dreams can be woven together with new ideas. Hope was and still is the commonality which encourages us to still believe in America. Hope is that one single thread that is woven in our lineage that solidifies our confidence. It is that belief that in spite of what we have faced, and what we still may face in the future. But because we are resilient, we're strong, we're determined, Just as the morning sun, we still rise. We must rise. And we shall rise. Because we are equal to the past. Give yourself a hand. It's because I had a front row seat at the table 50 years ago that allowed me to sue the majority white board because of racial discrimination. And I'm happy to report, ladies and gentlemen, that the judge upheld my decision all 5 times. One of those two in particular that I remember, as I bring my comments to a close, who has had a positive impact on the state of Mississippi, is the implementation of a fair jury selection system. Prior to my election, as soon as the board, the circuit court arbitrarily and capriciously selected whomever he chose to serve on a jury, particularly if it had meaning for a black family. And so when I took my board to court and the judge ruled, his decision was that every 10th registered voter would become a juror. And that system is now universal in the state of Mississippi. While we may not be able to right every wrong, while we may not be able to make justice out of injustice, we still can speak truth to power. We still can be on the cutting edge of bringing about change. We can still speak truth to power and try to eradicate all forms of discrimination, even though you may not be in the majority. When I travel the country, it makes me proud to say I'm from Mississippi, a state that has more black elected officials than any other state in the country. It makes me proud to say that. So I encourage each of us to remain engaged and take our involvement to another level. Because when we have a front row seat at the table, we can ensure that signs like these never, ever appear again in America, in this great land of America, which has been great since our ancestors came over, because they helped to build. Their blood, sweat, and tears helped to build and keep America great for centuries, not for the past 2 years. Finally, did I say it? Finally, it's up to each of us to make our communities better for all people, red, yellow, brown, black, and white. Let's leave this space today with new expectations, with new ideas, and with a renewed sense of hope that we will eventually and completely root out systemic racism in all of its forms. Because we marched too far. We sang too long. We prayed too hard. We suffered too much. And we died too young to allow someone to tell us that we cannot have a seat at the table, a front row seat at the table. Thank you.
Federal Public Defender's Office in Seattle, Washington.
In 1988, he began a 27-year private practice at the Seattle firm of Shorter, Goldmark, and Bender. There, he represented a broad range of clients in local, state, and federal court on charges ranging from shoplifting to security fraud and first-degree murder. He has tried more than 200 criminal cases to verdict and has tried more than a dozen civil cases representing plaintiffs suing corporate and government entities. Joe has a whole lot of accolades, y'all, but I will say that's not why I invited Jeff to Mississippi. Y'all, I didn't invite Jeff because of his extremely impressive bio, so I'm not even going to read the rest of it. Let me tell you why I invited Jeff. I asked him to come to New York because he is Jeffrey Robinson, the ACLU Deputy Regional Director and the Director of the Toronto Center for Justice and Equality. That's a very impressive title you got there. But that's not why I invited him. I invited Jeff to Mississippi because he is cornbread and collard green face. Jeff grew up right up the road in Memphis. His passion for racial justice was ignited at the age of 11 after he attended a march led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That march ended in violence, and it ended just a week before Dr. King was assassinated. But Jeff's passion didn't go out. His passion, his fire for justice had not been quenched. And because of that, I invited him because I want you to know about the fire that is within. Without delay, please help me welcome Jeff Robinson.
Hey, y'all. I cannot tell you how privileged I feel to be here to talk with you tonight. Both of my parents have passed on, and if they are watching right now, they are both laughing their heads off, saying, "We thought this was one of my giving us in trouble, but this kind of trouble." I will start my remarks off tonight with something that I read in the Philadelphia Inquirer. And the title of this article is "Why the Blood of a 1955 Mississippi Murder Drenches Today's U.S. Senate Race." I want to be clear, as Jennifer said, this is not about voting. The ACLU has its power by remaining neutral in voting. We want people to vote, but we will never endorse a candidate. I am looking at the seat that says Senator Cindy Hyde Smith, and it is empty. And there will be times tonight where I will be talking to that seat, and I just want you to know that. So share with me for a moment this. The cause of the killing of Lamar Smith, which occurred in broad daylight before a crowd of people outside the Lincoln County Courthouse in Brookhaven, Mississippi, on August 13, 1955, is still considered an unsolved murder, but only in the most technical sense of the term. The truth is, there wasn't much mystery about it then or now. The 63-year-old local farmer and veteran of World War I, known as a fearless activist for his Black community and for a similar civil rights group called the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, crumpled from a gunshot. He was shot in front of dozens of people, including the county sheriff. Now, there is not any debate over why Lamar Smith was killed. At the instant that he was gunned down, Lamar Smith was carrying a bundle of absentee ballots for an upcoming county election, the fruit of his idea for how African Americans in the Brookhaven area could cast votes without the white violence they likely encounter at a polling place on election day, That happened 4 years before Senator Sidney Hyde Smith was born in that exact same town, right here in Mississippi. And so her comments about a front row seat to a public hanging and her comments about keeping students from certain colleges from voting ring loud and clear. And part of what I would like to talk with you about tonight is the fact, and maybe it's the fact that this audience is quite aware of, that this is nothing new. So one thing I would like to do, one thing I have learned as a trial lawyer, is that if you are going to talk to a group of people about something, everybody needs to be on the same page. And I saw a guy give a presentation once where he said, I can say to a group of people, there was a horrible accident outside on the street. And if I said nothing else, some people might picture two cars. Some people might picture a car and a truck. Some people might picture a van and a pedestrian. So you have to be specific. And I am going to use the term racism tonight. And I want you to know exactly what I mean when I use that word. And I think this will help.
A lot of people don't like my comedy. A lot of white people don't like my comedy.
Hey, Reverend.
Hey.
Get on stage. Make your jokes about white people. You think white people this? White people that?
What if I did something like that?
Huh?
What if I got on stage and I said, yeah, black people are like this. Muslims are like that. You'd probably call me a racist, wouldn't you? And I'd say, yeah, I would. Yeah, you should never do that. But it's time for your help.
Why would you do that, Amit? You do that, you get on stage, you make your jokes about white people.
Don't you think that's the kind of racism? Don't you think that's...
reverse racism.
No, I don't think that's reverse racism.
Not because, I think reverse racism doesn't exist, right? If you ask some black and brown people, they'll tell you flat out
there is no such thing as reverse racism. I don't agree with that. I think there is such a thing as reverse racism, and
I could be a reverse racist
if I wanted to, or I would need to be a time machine, right? And what I do is I get in my time machine, I go back in time, before you were colonized the world, right? And convince the leaders of Africa, Asia, Middle East, Central and South America to invade and colonize Europe, right? Just occupy them, steal their land and resources. Set up some kind of, like, I don't know, trans-Asian slave trade where we exported white people to work on giant rice plantations in China. Just ruin Europe over the course of a couple of centuries, so all their descendants would want to migrate out and live in the places where black and brown people come from. Of course, in that time, I've made sure I set up systems that privilege black and brown people at every conceivable social, political, and economic opportunity. White people would never have any hope of re-self-determination. Just every couple of decades, make up some fake war as an excuse to go and bomb them back to the Stone Age. Or to their own good because their culture is inferior and just kicks. Subject white people to colored people's standards of beauty and end up hating the color of their own skin, eyes, and hair. After hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of that, I got on stage at a comedy show and said, hey, what's the deal with white people? How can't they dance? That would be reverse racism.
I can be the most prejudiced person in this room. I can be the most bigoted person in this room. But in America, I cannot be a racist. Because racism is more than just prejudice. Racism is prejudice plus social power plus legal authority. And black and brown people in America have never had the latter two. Not during the slave trade, not during the civil rights movement,
not from Barack Obama, from the White House. And the answer is not that. So we need to understand what we mean when we use that term, racist. And when Governor Roberts and I were talking about this presentation, we were talking about there needs to be a recognition of the history of racism, not just in Mississippi, but in America. And I want to spend a few minutes with you tonight going over just where the lynching mentality comes from. And just where the desire to hold on to that mentality, the desire to say something like, I have a front row seat at a public hanging, and then turn to the black people and say, if you're offended by that, you're just crazy. Where does that come from? Well, we have heard these kind of things before.
That's what America is about. A land of dreams and opportunity. There were other immigrants who came here in the bottom of slave ships, worked even longer, even harder for less. But they too had a dream that one day their sons, daughters, grandsons, granddaughters, great-grandsons, great-granddaughters might pursue prosperity and happiness in this land.
Jennifer told you in her introductory remarks that words matter. Enslaved people were not immigrants. They did not come here with dreams of prosperity. They came here with nightmares because they couldn't even understand the language of the people that kidnapped them to bring them here, although they could understand the language of the whip, because that is a universal language that everyone understands. You heard Ben Carson say their sons and daughters, grandsons and granddaughters, great-grandsons and great-granddaughters. You can almost see the wheels turning where he's thinking, I got to go pretty far before we get to, like, prosperity. If we're talking about the great-great-grandsons and granddaughters of the original 20 enslaved people that landed here in 1619, they wouldn't have been halfway through the quarter millennium of slavery in the United States. Words matter, and a narrative about what the past was matters.
People don't know what, you know, Civil War.
Yeah.
Think about it. Why? People don't ask that question. But why was there the Civil War? Why could that one not have been worked out? I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart, and he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this.
No, there's nothing wrong with that. And of course, what I want to talk about is framed for us by George Orwell in his book, 1984. Orwell didn't write about a year. He wrote about a mindset of oppression. And one of the critical things he said in that book is, who controls the past controls the future. Because if you control the narrative of what happened in the past to bring us to November 19, 2018, then you control the narrative of what should be happening going forward. Who controls the past controls the future. This is at the bottom of Senator Hyde-Smith's comments, because she was unwilling to let go of that past. Here are a couple of things that are wrong with what our president just said. Andrew Jackson was dead almost 16 years before the Civil War started. That's the first problem. The second problem is that he suggested Andrew Jackson was this tough but loving person. And he looked at the Civil War and said, there's no reason for this. If Andrew Jackson ever said
that there's no reason for something like the Civil War, it would have been because he would have been saying there's no reason to stop enslaving black people. If you want to know who Andrew Jackson was, don't listen to anybody who's alive today, including me. Go to the history books. And one of those books is called American Slavery as It Is, written by Weld and Grimke in 1839. And what Weld and Grimke did was to go around the country collecting newspaper articles about slavery. And they just put all the newspaper articles in a book, American Slavery as It Is. You can still find a copy of this book in the Library of Congress. You want to know who Andrew Jackson was? Listen to who Andrew Jackson was in his own words.
Stop the runaway. $50 reward. A look from the subscriber living near Nashville on the 21st of June last. A mulatto man slave, about 30 years old, 6 feet and an inch high, stout made and active, talks sensible, stoops in his walk, and has a remarkably large foot, broad across the root of the toes, will pass for a free man, as I am informed he has obtained by some means certificates as such. Took with him a drab great coat, dark mixed body coat, a ruffled shirt, cotton homespun shirts, and overall. He will make for Detroit through the states of Kentucky and Ohio, or the upper part of Louisiana. The above reward will be given any person that will take him and deliver him to me, or secure him in jail so that I can get him. If taken out of the state, the above reward and all reasonable expenses paid, and $10 extra for every 100 lashes any person will give him, to the amount of 300. Andrew Jackson, near Nashville, state of Tennessee.
And $10 extra for every 100 lashes that a person will give him, to the amount of 300. That's who Andrew Jackson was, a slaver and a killer. He also happened to be president of the United States.
They are often the kinds of kids who are super predatory. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heal.
This has got nothing to do with Republican versus Democrat. This has to do with America. I have to do with America. Because Senator Clinton, back then when she made those statements, was supporting her husband's 1994 crime bill, which is one of the most devastating things that happened to African Americans in this country. And if you look at what's happening at the border, now, talk about that for just a minute, because Americans are so concerned, and I understand why. My God, we are ripping families apart at the border. We are taking children away from their parents and destroying these families. Oh, my God, we're using religion to justify it. The Attorney General and the Press Secretary say, well, the Bible justifies this. And part of what I want to suggest is, there is a pattern here. If you are going to oppress a group of people, you first have to steal their humanity. And so what do we call the people coming towards our border through Mexico? The horde, the invaders, they're drug sellers, they're killers, they're rapists. We call them names so that we can take away their humanity, because it's much easier to suppress somebody that you don't see as human. Today, when we talk about the opioid crisis, oh my God, it's the opioid crisis. We can't have a war on our children. How can you have a war on our children? We'll destroy the next generation. We have to look at this not as a criminal justice problem, but as a health problem.
I am not being sarcastic. That is absolutely the right way to think about it. My question is, when the kids look like that, that's not what we're here. So we have heard politicians before make statements that reveal a deeply problematic view of race in America. This is nothing new with your sitting senator from the state of Mississippi. I'm wondering, there we go. Don't read this book. If you haven't read it, don't read it. This is one of the most disturbing books that you will ever see in your entire life. It is about childhood sexual abuse. It's about drug addiction. It's about heroin. And William Burroughs, when he wrote this book, it is, you just take my word for it. It's an amazing thing. But what I want to talk to you about is the title of the book. Because his Beat Generation partner, Jack Kerouac, gave him the title. And when Burroughs was asked, what does the title Make It Lunch mean? What he said was, and I think that moment when everyone has to look at what is really on the end of their fork. And I'm going to ask you to have a naked lunch moment with me tonight about race in America, to look at what is really on the end of our collective forks when we sit as Americans and think about these issues. So where did this lynching mindset come from? It came from the people who founded America. Because in 1619, 20 and odd enslaved people landed in Jamestown. Next year, on August 20th, it will be the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved people arriving in America. And less than 20 years after they arrived in 1636, the first American slave ship was built, not on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi or Alabama, but in Massachusetts. So this myth about the evil South and the pure North, I'm sorry, everybody was in on it. And look at the name of the ship, the Desire. And the next three ships were the Fortune, the Hope, and the Prosperity. This is the way Americans considered the concept of owning other people as property. Language matters. And if you look at what people say about what they did, you can often find out a lot. In 1662, Virginia passed a law. Children of enslaved mothers are enslaved. Why would they need that law? Because white male slave owners were systematically raping the black women that they owned as property. And what Virginia was saying is, we just want to be clear. If those babies come out with blue eyes or freckles, don't go thinking they're people. They're slaves. In 1667, Virginia had to deal with the concept that many enslaved people were becoming Christians. And now there's a conflict, because if we're in the heart of Christianity, it is really hard to look at another person and say, you are not a human being, you are a piece of property. But Virginia figured that out, because they said, this doesn't make any difference, because the only way an enslaved person could ever become Christian would be through the charity and piety of their owners. Americans considered charity and piety as perfectly consistent with owning people as property. In 1669, Virginia passed another law. The death of an enslaved person while resisting a master is not a felony. I'm not saying this law is still on the books. What I am saying is this: how many black and brown people have you seen on video being beaten or in the last 10 years? And I will say this, that law may not be on the books anymore, but it damn sure seems to still be the law in America. Between 1689 and 1865, Virginia enacted more than 130 quote-unquote slave statutes. And I show this to you to have you understand this was not just about personal choice and personal prejudice. The structures of the law in America were intimately intertwined with the conditions under which Americans would own other people as property. The law was in it up to its neck. In 1739, there was a revolt of enslaved people in Stono, South Carolina, one of the most violent revolts in American history. There were white people who were actually beheaded. And South Carolina didn't take long. They said, we can't have that. Within 1 year, they passed a 58-chapter slave statute, which was passed for this reason, in their words, not mine, so that slaves may be kept in due subjugation and obedience. This is where the lynching mentality comes from. It is deeply American. And what we are seeing here is the concept that America was founded. America was founded on the philosophy of white supremacy. That's a disturbing statement to say, but many times the truth is a disturbing thing. And remember, we're having a naked lunch moment tonight. By 1755 in Georgia, they passed a law saying, you white plantation owners and white folks that work for white plantation owners, y'all got to join the militia. Because there's only two ways that you can keep a group of people enslaved. Number one, by the use of horrific, random violence. And number two, by the threat of horrific, random violence. In order to carry out either of those things, you need people carrying guns. And so Georgia said, you white folks got to join the militia because we need you. I'm sorry, my clicker is malfunctioning a little bit. Joseph Clay, a Savannah merchant in 1784, says this, the Negro business is a great object with us. It is to the trade of the country as the soul is to the body, and without it, no house can gain proper stability. Listen to those words. He is saying this as clearly as we possibly can. And by 1790, about 170, or what would it be, 170 years from 1619, cotton production by enslaved labor had reached 1.5 million pounds a year. Now, I can ask this question because it's where I am, and I think I will get more answers than I did this morning when I gave a presentation like this in New Jersey to 700 judges. How many folks in this room have ever held a freshly picked ball of cotton in your hand? Yeah, look at the hands that go up. And I ain't talking about the stuff you take out of an aspirin bottle, right? Y'all know exactly what I mean. Would you just help me and yell it out? How much did that freshly picked ball weigh? How many of those balls do you think it takes to get to 1.5 million pounds? I can't tell you how many cotton balls it took, but I can tell you how many enslaved people it took. 700,000. From 20 people in 1619, it had grown to 700,000 by 1790. Is it possible that concepts of white supremacy are embedded in our Constitution, in the document that we all revere as one of the most amazing documents ever produced? Well, the word slavery appears once in the Constitution. Do you know where? The 13th Amendment, you're absolutely right, abolishing slavery. Because the North understood that the Southern partners in the formation of America, they got uncomfortable when people would use the term slavery. And as we know, for God's sake, you don't want to make a white person uncomfortable. So they didn't use the term slavery. Article 1, Section 2, the three-fifths clause of the Constitution. Enslaved people will be judged and counted as three-fifths of a person. Article 1, Section 9, no ban on migration or importation of such persons. That's the term used in the Constitution, such persons. Because if we use the word slave or enslaved person, then we are marking ourselves as a country who feels that treating people as property is completely fine. And that would destroy the concept that we have a part of the greatness of America, right? So we can't have that.
Well, I'm going to have to stop right there and pause for the cause. The first thing is that I'd like to tell you about a book that I mentioned previously called Unknown Voices, and it's an 18 poetry series on topics ranging from education, work, society issues, emotions, death, fantasies, and it was written by Mr. Paul C. Willis. The book I've read on more than one occasion, and also heard him write some songs or some music that went with some of those particular poems. And a lot of my students when I was teaching at St. Paul's College were purchasers of that. If you're interested, you get in touch with Paul by going on your computer, putting Paul C, W-I-L-U-S-C, at gmail.com. And also, the same thing about let's get down to the days when your show is interviewing some other people. I'm presently having an opportunity, or may have an opportunity, to have a guest speaker from my show talk and discuss some of the issues that you've been hearing. And I will function more as a host than as I don't presently do, although I'm called one. What you've been listening to so far is Racism in Mississippi and America, and you had two speakers. In order for us to continue with this, you're going to have to listen at another time, basically because time factor will not allow me the opportunity of being able to do this. We have about 3 minutes left for the show. And I just wanted to talk to you about a few things. I just finished talking to you about a book called Unknown Voices. And I also want to tell you about a disc that Paul put together in music. And I'm one of the singers on it. And if you're interested in that, you can also get in touch with Paul by pcwillis@gmail.com. It's a number of songs that he's written. And one last thing that he did, he put together this remarkable coloring book. And it's written in such a way for children to be able to, on their early education group, be able to identify certain kinds of things. And using colors, actually. Excuse me. So, in order to hear the conclusion of this particular program, what you're going to have to do is tune in this coming Saturday. This coming Friday at 4:30. The show will go from 4:30 all the way to 6, and you'll be able to hear the conclusion of this particular presentation that actually deals with not only the identification of racism and how the fallacy of reverse racism is just that, a fallacy, because in order for you to be able to do something like that, you have to have a lot of power to cause what happens. People make decisions. Those particular decisions are the ones of people in power that are making those particular decisions. So it's impossible for a large group of black people to be able to do that kind of thing because most often they don't have the power. The only one who may have had the power but didn't know what to do with it was President Obama. And we know that the president we have right now doesn't know what to do with it either. So this has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean. I will be back to visit you again on Friday at 4:30, and we will continue with this particular presentation. Have a good day and have a good week. Bye-bye.